This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. It's Andrew West here on RN. If you've cashed in on COVID, do you have to share the wealth?
Contrary to what most people imagine, who think, yeah, it's the rich giving money to the poor, most philanthropy goes to elite institutions, places where the rich have actually been trained, educated, benefited and treated.
That's ahead on the show. And Pope Francis has endorsed the controversial idea of a universal basic income, and that's later. It's been a good pandemic for some. Jeff Bezos, the world's richest man, has reportedly seen his wealth almost double from $113 billion to $203 billion in just 6 months. So are the wealthy now obliged to share these phenomenal riches? Do they have to be philanthropists? Paul Vallely discusses the obligations and the controversies of charity in his new book, Philanthropy, From Aristotle to Zuckerberg, and he joined me from London.
Aristotle said that giving was good for the giver because it helped form the moral character of the giver. Aristotle's ethics are all about moderation. He sees different extremes, and there's a midway point in all of them. And that kind of generosity is a sign that you've achieved that in that particular area. So although he was part of a Greek tradition which was really focused on society, the place of the elite in society, he really stood out with his moral high ground. But the Greek position generally was that they expected rich men to, and it was men mainly, to fund something in society, whether it was just something small like commissioning a new play from Aeschylus, which is where the first time that philanthropy is used as a word, or sending a team to the Olympics, or something huge like building a temple or a trimarine, a warship. They expected rich people to do that. Indeed, rich people vied with one another to prove their social superiority by doing that. So it was very much a top-down phenomenon, and that characterizes a lot of philanthropy today. And as I say, in parallel, there's this Jewish tradition, which is quite different.
Well, I'm going to ask you about those religious traditions in a moment, but you do raise this interesting point early on in the book. How much is philanthropy about altruism and how much is it about ego?
It's about both. Sometimes you can't separate the two because people think they're being altruistic, but it's feeding their ego to be altruistic. And then it raises all the kind of complex questions like, is it better to be self-deluded and egotistical but doing good than not to be doing good? And there are all kinds of moral hierarchies which emerge in the course of this book in different ways. But philanthropy has been an awful lot more than either altruism or egotism. It's been forms of social control. It's been a response to religious injunction. It's been a raft of things. And part of the point of the book is that it looks at the 2,500 years of philanthropy and points out where it's been different.
In the case of the Bible, Paul, did you sort out this tension between charity and welfare, as it were? Because I know that the Bible calls on people to give alms, it calls on people to be generous to the poor, but there's also a debate, isn't there, in the Bible about whether it mandates some form of sort of welfare. I think the Old Testament said you had to set aside 10% of your crops. This wasn't random, this was very systematic. So what does the Bible actually say about what we would today call the charity-welfare tension?
It says lots of things. You're not just giving away 10% of your crop. You're expected to leave the corners and the edges of the field so that the poor can come and pick them, garner them. The poor are expected to do that themselves. It's not charity that's given away. It's there for them to go and graze the field to try and find these extra grains. So they're expected to work for it, but you're expected to leave it for them. And one of the things that is key to this is that there's a kind of notion of mutual responsibility. You know, the rich have a duty materially to help the poor. This then goes through the whole of Christianity and dominates philanthropic thinking for 1,000 years, from the 4th century to the 14th. The idea that the rich have to help the poor materially, but the poor have a duty to pray for the rich because, as the Bible says, God hears the prayers of the poor before he hears those of the rich. And so the poor's prayers have priorities.
Your book is a sweeping history of the idea of philanthropy, including the Victorian era and some of the attitudes that took shape there. But we have to jump to some of the controversies that this interesting book has generated. When we talk about philanthropy today, what sort of money are we talking about? Because you've got a staggering figure there.
Over the past 20 years, philanthropy has grown exponentially. World inequality has grown, global wealth has grown. There's a kind of correlation between those. And amongst the global wealthy, philanthropy has grown. Three quarters of the world's philanthropic foundations have been founded in the past 20 years. You've got tech titans in California who earn unthinkable amounts of money in the way that Andrew Carnegie did, the first big modern philanthropist at the turn of the previous century, the steel magnate. He was the richest man in the world. And so today you've got $1.5 trillion is held and distributed by philanthropists. So it's a significant figure nowadays.
Of course, to put it in perspective, though, that's a staggering figure. But there's another staggering figure that you've also mentioned. Just how concentrated is the world's wealth?
It's almost the case that half of the world's wealth is owned by 1% of people. And the other half is divided up between the 99% of the rest of us. That's how staggering the inequality is.
Yeah, but there's a figure that's even more stunning. Don't eight men, have as much wealth as the bottom half of the world's population?
If you trawl through the figures on inequality, you can get some staggering contrasts between individuals, groups of individuals, classes, and the rest of us. But what they all add up to is the same thing, that inequality has grown, and it is still continuing to grow, and the pandemic is exacerbating that.
Yeah, and another figure that you raise in the book, 25 hedge fund managers on Wall Street make more money than every single kindergarten teacher in the US put together. So, well, how is the pandemic exacerbating this?
One hedge fund in England was reported a couple of weeks ago, made £2.4 billion out of the stock market crash when the pandemic first happened. So there are people making that kind of amount of money out of a system where children go to bed hungry. So that kind of vast inequality, you know, raises clear moral questions and is getting worse, not better.
Now, you level a lot of very well-researched criticism at certain types of philanthropy, and we will get to that. But let's speak up for it a bit as well. The most famous philanthropist in the world at the moment is probably Bill Gates. And you acknowledge what Gates has done with polio, which I think is what? How much polio has he managed to eliminate?
Well, there were 1,000 kids a day got polio a couple of decades ago. Bill Gates has helped vaccinate 2.5 billion children against polio. And polio has been declared as an eradicated disease throughout India, in almost all of Africa. What they call wild polio has gone from the world, rather like smallpox was eradicated. And that is something which just has improved millions and millions of lives. And that's, you know, largely down to the inspiration of one man. So the effectiveness and the generosity of someone like Gates can't be underestimated.
You do, however, qualify your praise of Bill Gates. There's a but after the praise for Bill Gates. What is it?
The but is that when one man has got a lot of money and a lot of power and decides to do something, if he chooses the right thing to do, that's great. And if he chooses the wrong thing to do, it's not so good. So he put $2 billion into education early on in America. And after a few years, he decided that the project, which was to try and make big schools smaller in lots of parts of America, wasn't really working. And he just kind of called all the educationists of America together and announced that he was dropping this and he was going to change to a different tack, looking at the performance of teachers. He's very kind of data-driven and performance-orientated, Bill Gates. It's all about business measurement and metrics. So he did that, failed experiment for an extraordinarily rich man. What's $2 billion to you and me? But to the kids involved, you know, they'd had years of education, which was, if not lost, could have been better. And kids can't get that back in the way that a philanthropist can move on to the next project. So it raises the question, who is a philanthropist accountable to, and what's their relationship to the rest of society is increasingly throughout the world democratic. People have a right to influence these decisions, but with philanthropists, you don't have a right. Now, to be fair to Bill Gates, he's learned over the decades that he needs to listen more. And Melinda, his wife, has been particularly key on emphasizing the need for partnership rather than just technical solutions. And you can have the most brilliant technical solution. It won't work if you can't persuade people to use the vaccine or to employ the strategy. What I recommend in the book, which is this idea of reciprocal philanthropy, is something that Gates has moved much more towards.
It's the Religion and Ethics Report, Andrew West with you. My guest today, Paul Vallely. He's the author of the new book, Philanthropy from Aristotle to Zuckerberg. We're talking here now about a clique of very super wealthy people who have very publicly pledged to give away money. Tell me about this secret meeting in May 2009.
Gates and Warren Buffett and a few other key figures invited about 20 of the world's richest people to come together at a secret meeting in New York. And they discussed, you know, what could they do to try and ameliorate some of the problems of the world, which seem to be getting bigger. And they came up with this giving pledge. Now, the giving pledge has an interesting provenance. The inspiration for it was a man called Chuck Feeney, who is an Irish-American who made $8 billion from duty-free shops. And he became known as the James Bond of philanthropy because he gave away so much of his money undercover for years, anonymously, until a court case laid bare his identity. He would do this. His philosophy was giving while living, and he wanted to give away all his money before he died. In fact, he said he wants his last check to bounce. He said a thing called Atlantic Philanthropies, which just 2 months ago closed down and gave away the last of his $8 billion. And he lives very modestly for a millionaire. Well, he's not a billionaire anymore. He's only a millionaire now. I think he's got about $1 million left to last the rest of his life. That idea of giving while living inspired Bill Gates and Warren Buffett to devise this giving pledge to persuade their fellow billionaires to give away at least half of their fortune before they die.
It didn't persuade everyone, though, because the world's richest man, Jeff Bezos, I think he has failed to sign up to any giving pledge. And in fact, if anyone's made a mozza, as we say, out of the pandemic, it's probably Jeff Bezos, because a lot of local shops have been devastated while people buy online from Jeff Bezos's website.
I would estimate that Jeff Bezos is worth twice now what he was at the beginning of the pandemic. It's made a huge difference. A lot of the top 10 richest people have had their fortunes increase significantly as a result of the pandemic. You know, in these situations, there are always winners and losers. Jeff Bezos has started to get into philanthropy a bit more than he has been in the past. But yes, he didn't sign that pledge. His ex-wife has just signed it. She got $60 billion in a divorce from him. And she's just announced a very extensive program of very progressive philanthropy.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned two people, the two movers and shakers behind that giving pledge were Bill Gates and Warren Buffett. Now, interestingly, both of those men have also said, we need to pay higher taxes. The government should take more money from us in taxes. How big is this debate in the philanthropic world? Because surely, as you point out in your book, there's a lot of people who say, we don't want to pay taxes. We'll be philanthropic and we'll decide where we give our money. So where are these people who want to be philanthropists? Where are they directing their money? Because, again, you've got a very interesting statistic there.
They direct it all over the place. But contrary to what most people imagine, who think, yeah, it's the rich giving money to the poor, most philanthropy goes to elite institutions. Higher education, you know, places like Oxford and Cambridge get more money than any other university in England. There will be American and no doubt Australian equivalents. Top hospitals, places where the rich have actually been trained, educated, benefited and treated. Opera houses get more money than women's refuges and so forth. One of the things about philanthropy is that it's distributed according to the whim of the individual philanthropist, which is very often governed by, you know, the events of his own life. So he went to this school, this college, this university, so he gives money to that. His mom died of breast cancer, so he puts money into breast cancer research. It's quite responsive to the human emotion and experience of the philanthropist. It's not at all systematic or organized or some would say fair.
Yeah, I think you say in the book that in the United States, at least, 80% of philanthropy actually goes to elite cultural, educational, medical facilities and causes. Now, you pose this question. You don't say it as some sort of declaration. It is just a question. Can philanthropy undermine democracy? What's the answer, Paul?
Philanthropy undermines democracy in some ways, because if a rich man gets tax relief on his donation, his mega donation to an opera house, that tax relief comes from the taxpayers. So he's choosing to give his money to an opera house rather than to a school for poor kids or a refuge for battered women. The taxpayer is paying for it. He makes the choice. He pays part of it, but we pay part of it. If you look at surveys, you find that the social views of the rich are very different to the rest of us. They're more free market, they're more right wing. And so their social priorities are not necessarily our social priorities. So if we're paying for their social whims, there's a democratic deficit in that. So there's a big question mark over that. The other side of the argument is that philanthropists stand in an in-between place. You know, you've got the market, you've got the state. Philanthropists can do things that businesses won't do because they're not profitable, and governments won't do because they don't fit into the next electoral cycle. And they can stand as an alternative voice. If you look at Bill Gates, one of the great things he did was that in 2014, after the Ebola crisis, he gave a talk, a TED talk, in which he said, just suppose we had an Ebola crisis, a crisis with a disease as deadly as Ebola, but just suppose it was as infectious as flu. What might happen then? We might have 10 million people die. And lo and behold, here we are with something which is not as deadly as Ebola, but pretty deadly and as infectious as flu. And he warned about it every year. He made speeches and went to government. So he went to see Donald Trump. Donald Trump responded by actually cutting the budget for disease control and pulling out of the World Health Organization. But there he was as an alternative voice to business, to government. He's performed a great function. And while governments have been so blundering, and I mean, in Australia, you've handled the pandemic comparatively well when you look at the rest of the world, but some governments have done terribly. And Gates there has put money into five of the companies that are developing different vaccines. He's put $600 million into vaccine treatments and the fair distribution of it around the world. He's got the biggest vaccine manufacturer in the world in India lined up to produce the vaccines for $3 a shot. It's all very well saying that Bill Gates is not accountable for the way that he spends his money, but when you look at that, he's doing a lot better than a lot of governments.
It's a good place to end, Paul. Paul Vallely, he's a British writer. His new book is Philanthropy, From Aristotle to Zuckerberg. Paul, thank you for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thanks for having me.
In this year of pandemic, of being shut in and working from home, you might have been delivering food to someone who was even more housebound, or trying to help your kids grapple with online schooling. Pope Francis has been doing a lot of writing. First, there was that long paper letter, and now a book co-written with his biographer, Austin Ivory. It's called Let Us Dream, The Path to a Better Future. And Austin Ivory joins us from Oxford. Welcome, Austin.
Hi, Andrew.
Has the COVID pandemic helped the Pope crystallize his thoughts on how the world can improve?
Well, the way I put it is that I think in many ways the pandemic has relaunched his pontificate. What I mean by that is that clearly when it came out of nowhere in February, March, caught us all by surprise. And over Easter, really became clear that he was seeing this crisis in a very deep and a very urgent way. The crisis presented the world with a choice. So I think in many ways he's been energized, if like, by the pandemic, because I think he sees that this is a moment, as he puts it in Let Us Dream, it's a threshold moment, a moment of choice where we have to choose. And I think, you know, he's always, as they used to call him in Argentina, storm pilot. You know, it's always in moments of crisis that he gets going.
I know that you and the Pope had to cooperate via email, but I do wonder whether, and I say this in a good way, whether you guys had been Googling articles to each other to read, because there's a lot in this book, in this contemplation, that touches on a lot of breaking news events.
Yeah, well spotted, Andrew. Yeah, no, in fact, see, this isn't an interview. Most papal books are, in fact, all of them have been always question and answer, you know, with the journalist. This is a very tightly focused book. It's focused on the pandemic, even though it's full of all kinds of other issues. But it goes very deeply into a number of questions which required much more than just simply an exchange. So, yes, I asked him questions. He would reply often with fairly, you know, substantial recorded answers, which I would be sent as audio files. But equally, he would say, look, you know, I think that article there or my piece of writing back there, which, of course, as his biographer, I'm very familiar with his writings from his Jesuit era and his era as an archbishop. So it really became much more of a kind of a work of collaboration with lots of different kinds of raw materials with a very strong narrative.
I notice that he talks about the Me Too movement. Then he talks about the murder of George Floyd. And then he talks about the street demonstrations against lockdowns and says, well, you know, you didn't go out to protest George Floyd's death, but you went out to protest against wearing a mask. I mean, it does seem like the Pope spent a lot of time, probably like another certain leader, watching a lot of television news, although he doesn't tweet at 3 a.m.
Yeah, well, I think he was very aware of what was happening. We did this over the summer, so we started work on it in June. We finished really at the end of August. So the Black Lives Matter movement, the killing of George Floyd, all that was sort of happening around us, plus the protests against the use of masks. Of course, a lot of religious people, including Catholics, as he points out in the book, which were objecting to the health measures on freedom of religion grounds, which he found completely spurious. So it was fascinating because the first part of the book, which is called A Time to See, is him really looking at the world at this moment through the eyes of the Good Shepherd and seeing the movements of the Spirit, what is of God, what is not of God, a very kind of Jesuit way of looking at things. A big focus, of course, on the peripheries, on the suffering, because a big argument of the book, and in fact, perhaps one might say the underlying narrative of the book, is that these crises, moments of suffering, are moments also of potential change, because there's always a grace, as it were, on offer to us at this time.
It's also very political. For example, he puts himself in the position of a government leader having to decide between the economy and lives. What does he resolve there?
So his point there is that in a crisis like this, you can't simply carry on as normal, that it's a revealing, a clarifying moment, because it reveals what's in your heart. In a crisis, you have to choose. He says, for example, you know, governments have had to choose. Do they prioritise the health of their citizens, or do they try and keep the economy going and, you know, allow for a certain number of deaths and so on? All these involve, of course, profound ethical choices, which in themselves are very revealing.
I mean, I think his resolution is that if a choice is between saving lives and saving the economy, he says simply redesign the economy. Some people will say that's easier said than done.
His point is that really what this crisis is revealing is there are governments that frankly do not put the human life at the heart of their decisions because they're too focused on growth, on profit, on consumption. Now, you might say, well, those things are all necessary to keep us all going and keep us in jobs. And if he's not denying that. He's not denying the importance of the market, but he's saying, really, we have to put human dignity at the heart of the measures of economic success. So in other words, you know, economy isn't just about breakneck growth at the expense of the planet in order to enable huge amounts of consumption by one part of the world. A well-organized economy which puts human dignity at its heart allows everybody access to the goods of the earth, so, you know, land, labor, and lodging, as he puts it, and which integrate the poor and which bring about opportunity. And he talks very interestingly about a number of women economists who have come to the fore in recent years who have been arguing, if you like, for a more caring economy in which price and value are better linked. And what he means by that is that we actually need to learn how to put a price on certain kinds of work, which at the moment are not remunerated, but which are for the good of all. And of course, that in this crisis, we've seen, haven't we, you know, just how dependent we are on care workers who are often extremely badly paid. So it's actually a book really about value and about what value we put on things. And of course, the Christian part of that is that the recognition of the dignity of others that comes from the encounter with a merciful, loving God, it is there that we get our dignity. And what he's critiquing politically is, on the one hand, liberal individualism, technocracy, and on the other hand, a kind of national populism which exploits popular anguish but doesn't actually deliver for the people. And he's arguing for a very different kind of politics which really does take seriously the people as an agent of change.
We're about to have another debate on the rights of employees. Now, the Pope has a section about the rights of labour in this book. What does he say about the rights of labour?
He actually says at one point that labour, the question of work, is the great defining economic question of our time. What he means by that, of course, is, I mean, independently of the pandemic, we have a technological revolution in place, which is increasingly rendering work less available. And therefore, the commodification of work, you know, we're all, in other words, if we're seen as factors in production, then labour is losing value, at least a lot for a lot of people, particularly the lower down the social scale. So he's arguing, again, to rethink things like, and he talks about the universal basic income and a shorter working week. He's saying, I'm not an expert here, but these ideas seem to me to be addressing some of these questions. How can we have a society in which we understand that work is a good, it gives us dignity, it's part of the creativity that belongs to human dignity. How can we allow that in an economy in which labour is increasingly being replaced, people are increasingly being replaced by machines? So he's really saying this is the kind of rethinking we need, which the pandemic has clarified and accelerated the need for.
How significant is it, by the way, that the Pope does, it's not a full-blown endorsement, but it comes pretty close to endorsing this idea of the universal basic income. This came up in the US election, at least in the primary season. It's been raised by a lot of economists around the world. How significant is that? Because that's a very specific policy.
It is, and he's already received flack for it in the reception of the book. But I mean, I think back on Leo XIII back in 1891, talking about a just wage, you know, that the market alone was incapable of determining a just wage. And of course, half of the, you know, Catholic bourgeois businessmen of Europe said the Pope's mad or Marxist, you know. So sometimes these ideas are shocking because popes are sometimes ahead of people, or rather, they're up with the economists who are ahead of people. The Pope isn't an economist, and he's not getting into the weeds of the arguments, and there are lots of arguments, of course, for and against universal basic income. But he's arguing really for the principle behind the kind of thinking which would lead to that, which is to say, how do we organize our economy so that we have access to work as a good for all, even though some kinds of work that we do have very little remunerative value in the market economy. In other words, they're low priced. How can we put a greater value on that? Well, universal basic income is one of those ways, because it allows people a certain basic guaranteed income. And then, of course, every dollar or pound you pay above that, you pay tax on. But then it allows you to balance, perhaps to a greater extent, work which earns you money and other kinds of work which serves the community or which helps to regenerate the environment, which has a common good. In other words, it serves all of us. How can we also, it enables people to do that, for example. So that kind of thinking is what he gets into in part three, which is called The Time to Act, which is, you know, given what we now have seen in this crisis, seeing what humanizes, what dehumanizes, how can we move forward to a different kind of economy, and indeed a different kind of politics that enables that kind of economy.
And there is this wonderful humility that does come through, where he refers many times, I think, to his uncompleted PhD, something that I think a lot of listeners will relate to. Oh, that PhD, I never got finished.
Yes, I've always thought that, Andrew, that if Francis, after his death and so on, is ever canonised, I think he should be the patron saint of unfinished PhD students. You know?
Look, good to talk to you, Dr. Austin Ivory. Austin is the co-author with the Pope of the new book, Let Us Dream, The Path to a Better Future. Thanks for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you, Andrew. Great to be with you.
And there's an extract from that book by Austin and Pope Francis at the ABC Religion and Ethics Report homepage, and a longer version of our first interview with Paul Vallely. That's the show for this week. Thanks to Mudita Dias and Simon Branthwaite. I'm Andrew West. I'm back next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.